Last week at the Buddhist Centre in Nottingham, I did a talk. It was supposed to be about something else, but it ended up being about spiritual rebirth and spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Recently, it's very recent actually, this sort of a symbol has sort of popped up, symbol of the sea and sort of seafarers and sort of Moby Dick style kind of stories where you get these sort of rugged individuals out at sea sort of exploring and sort of quite close to sort of plunging in and sort of being shipwrecked, all this sort of thing. So this sort of symbol of the sea is quite strong for me at the moment, and I think it's quite a good symbol for this subject of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. I'll sort of keep referring to that through the talk. So I'll say a few things about the sea and how I see it in this sort of symbolic way. In the sea, you can drown if you can't swim, or if you're in it too long, it's too rough. And in the sea, there are depths as well, and there's the potential to sort of find treasure and tropical fish and sort of magic and beauty deep within the sea, mermaids and nagas and all this sort of thing. So the sea has this sort of two sides, in a way, the way I'm going to look at it, where it's sort of threatening to us. It's sort of frightening. We can become very disorientated if someone was just to sort of plop you in the sea, in the middle of a great ocean somewhere. You'd be quite sort of frightened and scared, disorientated, unsettled by that experience. But also, it has this other element, sort of as a symbol, that within the depths, there's this idea that there's treasure, that there's wisdom, if you like, in the Buddhist tradition. You have what are called the Nagas, and they live deep underwater. They're sort of serpent creatures, half man, half serpent, and they're considered sort of the keepers of wisdom. Apparently, if you meet a Naga and you're not well prepared, they're quite fierce and quite unpleasant figures. But if you meet them without fear and sort of you placate them in the right way, they reveal their wisdom to you. So I think you often see Nagas depicted alongside figures like Manjugosha, Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. Someone plops you in the sea and you feel insignificant in the sea. You feel overpowered, overwhelmed. It's this sort of great force of nature, and you sort of feel the scale of yourself. You feel your vulnerability in that kind of setting. And I also think the sea is a very good sort of symbol or something in which we can see impermanence and shunyata quite clearly. So shunyata, this idea that nothing has a fixed essence. So with the sea or with any sort of water, its form is sort of clearly not fixed. You put your hand in some water and it just sort of completely moves aside and sort of moves around, flows around you. It changes shape, it flows. It can be still under certain conditions, and under other conditions it can just sort of be erupting in great waves and whirlpools, depending on other conditions. But in a way everything is like this, but with the sea, with water, it's just that much more obvious that nothing, that it doesn't have a fixed nature, that it's completely sort of process. And in a way we ourselves, our bodies, our minds, and everything else in this world is of that nature. That's what Buddhism teaches, that everything is of this sort of fluid nature. So when we're sort of brave enough to dive into this ocean, it becomes transformed. When we're sort of brave enough to go into spiritual death, or spiritual drowning in this sense, what was at first fear then sort of transforms, and we find new depths to ourselves, we find new capacities, we find new types of pleasure, sort of more refined experiences of pleasure, and experiences of wisdom and understanding as well from going into what seems like a kind of death or a kind of loss of what we know. So what I'm proposing we do in sort of in relation to this symbol of the sea is initially just a little bit of paddling, just a little bit of toe dipping, and then as we sort of get a feel for it, I encourage you just to sort of dive in. You can always grab hold of the side, like in the swimming pool, if it gets too much. You always come back up, hopefully, with some help. But at times, like you might feel as though you're drowning. You might feel sort of overwhelmed and threatened by the experience. But it's almost that's part of the process. I'll sort of mention a few little experiences of from sort of meditation that seem to sort of be around this sort of territory of going into sort of uncharted territory and feeling very sort of vulnerable, but then you actually realise this new place is a bigger, freer, sort of more blissful way of being. You found more of yourself than you thought was there. So that's just a bit about the sea as a symbol, as I'm sort of going to use it. So I've got this little diagram. I've got three little pictures for you. And this one is my one to show spiritual ignorance. This is an idea I've pinched from a Rumi poem, which I might read at some point. And the idea here is this is sort of us on top of this rather rickety platform that's sort of tied together with string. I'm not quite sure the mechanics of it, but somehow that holds you above the sea. And then the sea is the sea as in how I've been describing it, sort of this symbol of, in a way, reality and sort of primary direct experience. So this is how we live our lives, in a way, when we're ignorant and spiritually ignorant. And I'll sort of tell us what this scaffolding is made of. I'll talk about what that is. It's sort of... I'm going to speak of it as sort of like our notions of ourselves, our stories about ourselves, what we sort of identify with, what Buddhism would sort of call the sort of the false notion of a self, of a fixed self. And this is what we let go of in spiritual death. This is what we have to sort of give up to get into the ocean, to get into real experience. So what does this sort of consist of, this construction? And in a way, it's sort of how our minds relate to ourselves and relate to our world. So it's all sorts of notions we have about ourselves, which in a way are really just sort of stories about ourselves and stories about the world, sort of all the little theories we've got about how we work and what defines us, how the world works and what this person is like, and all these kind of notions. And it can be tied up, these thoughts, these ideas and stories can be tied up in all sorts of objects and all sorts of important people in our lives. So it can be quite often we probably got some quite a strong association or a sort of identification with whatever our occupation is, or what we do with our time, what we do in our life. Or if we have a family or a girlfriend or children or whoever our relations are, that's probably quite tied up with how we think about ourselves, how we identify ourselves. And then there's so many sort of habitual ways that we think about ourselves, we talk about ourselves, and even sort of have images of the way we look and who we are and what we do and how we appear to others, all these kind of thoughts, ideas of ourselves. And it's these things are sort of kind of real on a certain level. It's not that they're completely fictional or completely illusory. It's all quite sort of, you can sort of point to what you're talking about. You can put it down, you can explain it in real experiences. But it's almost like we get so caught up in the ideas of these things that we probably find quite often we don't actually spend much time in the actual lived experience of these people that are close to us, or in this experience of what it is to be in my body, or actually be doing this activity that I identify with so strongly. We probably don't have that much of our lives that's sort of spent in that kind of direct experience of the actual living of it. It's almost like we're more in the stories of our lives than in the actual life of them. And Buddhism teaches that everything, like I sort of said, is just empty of anything fixed. Everything is impermanent and process. So all these things that we might identify with that sort of go to build up this structure that we kind of imagine we're perched upon, or we imagine that's giving us stability, they're all vulnerable. They're all subject to change. Certain conditions change, and that little strut there just won't support us anymore. It will start to crumble, or you'll have to sort of replace it in some way. So the things are like that. The objects that we invest in, or the relationships that we start to rely on, are all vulnerable in that kind of way. And then, of course, the stories are just one way of describing how we are and who we are. And there's a very definite sense. I've started to sort of feel this more strongly in my in relation to the stories I say and tell myself about who I am. I started to sort of really feel that they actually limit me, and they're actually getting a bit boring, and that they're only one way of describing who I am or what I'm capable of. And sort of the more Buddhist experience of a touch of the experience of what the Buddha teaches about what we can become, what our potential is, and sort of just having little experiences in meditation of something a bit bigger, the more it seems obvious that the true nature of ourselves is something much bigger than any of these stories about what our hobbies are, or where we've come from, or what our plans are, or where we're going on holiday. All these things are so sort of narrow and insignificant when you sort of start to contemplate what our true potential is, in terms of becoming like a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. These sort of stories are just pale in insignificance. So in a funny kind of way, it's spiritual death, the seeing through of all these stories and sort of letting go of defining ourselves by these things in our lives, I was thinking of it as it's actually seeing life, seeing what is actually the lived experience of things is spiritual death. I'll try and explain that a bit more in a minute. But if we actually felt what we were doing, if we actually were in touch with the ground beneath us, we'd be more in touch with life. That would sort of bring us down from these thoughts and bring us more in touch with life. So letting go into death is actually living more fully. I don't know if I'm getting that across, but I started to sort of see it in that way. It's a bit paradoxical. Our expectation is that we're going to lose everything, but really we stand to gain far more. So what we're hoping to happen, although we don't realise we're hoping it to happen, we're trying to avoid it at the same time, is spiritual death. So our little man has toppled off his perch. Something's happened, and it's been seen to be illusory, or something of life, impermanence, has just sort of broken through in some way or form. So I was going to talk about two different ways in which we can sort of come to a more real experience, sort of get into the real experience of life. And the two ways probably sort of cross over quite a lot in a way. They're not two distinct ways. And the first one is sort of a really central part of Buddhist teaching, and that's mindfulness. So in a way, this is how do we let go of these notions? How do we let that self die and drown in the ocean, or sort of come to life in the ocean? And this sort of bit of the talk is sort of comes from recently hearing Maitreya Bandhu talk on mindfulness. And if you ever get a chance to hear Maitreya Bandhu talk on mindfulness, it's really worth hearing him. And he sort of took us right back to sort of the roots of how the Buddha would have taught about mindfulness. So he used this term, prapancha. I'll say a bit more in a minute. So he encouraged his disciples to come into their direct experience, what he called their primary experience. And this is sort of the very raw experience of just what you touch, or the feel of the breath as you breathe, or an emotion, just feeling it like very at its rawest state before you start thinking about, before you start interpreting and telling stories about that experience. What the Buddha encouraged was just to come to that very first experience of contact with the world and with yourself. And he distinguish this from prapancha. This is I think it's a Pali word, and that means something like proliferating thoughts. So that it's all the kind of stories, all the associations that we start, our minds start to spin off into, all the kind of things that go into this scaffolding in the symbol. These notions of ourselves, these stories about life. Rather than the actual experience of life. So, to get to the sea, the sea in a way could be seen as this primary experience. So, if you were sort of immersed in the sea, you probably would, quite literally, if you were just dropped in the sea, you probably would become instantly aware of your primary experience and sort of your, particularly if it's quite cold or something, your stories would just sort of drop away by themselves because the experience is so strong. That's often the way, I think. If you sort of have some strong experience that's sort of out of your ordinary day-to-day experience, you do have that experience, like that you do. Your stories can just sort of stop, and you have to be just present with what's happening, because sometimes you've just got no categories or no stories about the new experience, so you find yourself very absorbed in what's going on. But the Buddha was sort of teaching that we can have that kind of absorption, whatever. We don't have to go bungee jumping to know what that is, thankfully. But you can have it in relation to something as ordinary as your own breath, moment to moment, or as ordinary as walking across the floor and feeling the contact of that. Or of course, it's not just about meditation. It can be in communication with a friend or anyone, or it could be just in taking in the experience of being in nature, or sort of seeing the sun in the morning. All of these things can be enjoyed much more fully if we can sort of come out of this prapancha, if we can come out of all these proliferating thoughts about the experience and actually be much closer to the experience. And the value of that, there's a few things to say about the value of that. Firstly, it's just more pleasurable straight away. Like any experience that you find yourself enjoying, you'll probably notice it's because you've become absorbed in what you're doing. You're enjoying the activity of it. You're not caught up in your mind. You're sort of painting or something, or you're reading a good book, and it's got all of you engaged with it. And then the same principle is there with sort of higher states of consciousness. So sort of what you might hear people talk about as dhyana, where your mind becomes more one-pointed on in a meditation or something, and you actually start to feel pleasure that just comes from that absorption. And also, it's at this level of primary experience where we're just touching and aware of what we're sensing quite directly, that you actually see what's going on, that you actually see that things are impermanent, or that things have no fixed essence. You can think about that, but it doesn't have the same impact as actually seeing it happen or feeling it happen in your own mind or with your own breath coming and going. So in relation to meditation, just to sort of draw this out a little bit more, I've had the experiences of been quite surprised in a way by how the breath, sort of very simple, ordinary experience, can be brought to life, can sort of seem like really deeply satisfying and fascinating, even though it's just the breath as it's always been, but it's just your attention has come to it for the first time perhaps. And what I've found is you can sort of end up in uncharted territory, to use a bit of seafaring metaphor, where like you're in such a different way to engage with your experience, that things are happening that haven't happened before. You're feeling your things that you've never felt before. You're experiencing sort of expansiveness that you've not known before. And at first, this sort of alarmed me, and it just unsettled me. I didn't know what I was experiencing. I didn't know what was going to happen next. And I didn't quite understand that kind of experience at first, but I think it's just the newness of stepping out of this quite sort of narrow way of seeing the world, sort of stepping off this sort of scaffolding and actually experiencing things more directly. And then what I found, like, after you sort of realise that that's just what it is, it's just a new sort of territory, you're exploring somewhere for the first time, you actually find that place is quite pleasurable, that expanded state is better than previous experiences. And you sort of get this confidence to sort of keep going along off on the frontier. You're a bit of a Captain Cook by this point. So that's sort of mindfulness in a way, sort of what just bringing attention can do for us, and how that can help us sort of step off, or sort of even dive off this platform of how we sort of narrowly define ourselves and narrowly see our experience. And then a bit more death-like and drowning-like, a bit more fear-provoking is sort of what I'll talk about next. Everything I say is sort of borrowed from someone else who I heard talk. So this is Subhuti. I've got a bit from Subhuti now. I went to hear him talk about the spiritual death and spiritual rebirth at the London Buddhist Centre quite recently. I think it's on, you can watch it on a video. And it was a really inspiring sort of talk he gave about this. And he talked about how, as part of Buddhist practice, one thing we can do is actually start to court, this is how he phrased it, sort of court experiences where things fall apart, where things go wrong. I don't think he was suggesting that you start deliberately throwing spanners into the works and like set your house on fire or things like this. I think things will go wrong. You don't need to artificially bring this about. Your plans will have hiccups and things will change. But sort of be prepared, and sort of when something like that happens, see it as like an opportunity to feel more directly. Like when that happens, your structure is sort of just knocked aside, and you're immersed in this sea. And that's an opportunity for you to sort of feel something more directly. to feel a kind of freedom that you didn't have before because of this narrow life you'd sort of set out for yourself. So this can be from something relatively minor to sort of something really quite tragic. So it could be from a train cancellation to a mild humiliation in a study group where someone you get something wrong and you were very firm about it. Or the end of a relationship or the loss of a loved one or something. All of these things will have that effect of it, sort of disruption, and what you took to be sort of sturdy foundations will be sort of exposed for what they are, in a way that you were relying too much on something that was impermanent or subject to change. And the Subhuti talked about what he described as the middle of the night experience. And this was something that is sort of common to any human being will probably be familiar with what he's getting at here. It's just sort of those moments where we sort of wake up in the middle of the night. Perhaps it happens a lot more on retreat, actually. It does for me. And you kind of think, oh my God, it's going to go wrong. I'm going to lose my job. Or if I don't do this, it's all going to fall apart. And it's these sort of moments where you actually realise how... Well, you see how impermanence affects your life. Things aren't secure and sorted. Things are dependent. Things are conditioned. So it's not all safe. It's not all secure. But he says that these have two sides. So they have the element that scares us and we recoil from them. But they also... he talks about them having... at times a sort of moment of freedom and delight that we can experience before our reaction sets in. And he says this about those experiences, that they are, what's happening is our notion of a fixed self is fraying at the edges. It's us looking down and sort of seeing that we're standing on this spindly tower of sort of fragile things that we're attached to. And Buddhist practice, he says, trains us, sort of builds up our capacity to stay with these experiences, to stay at the stage where they're sort of opening out and offering possibilities, so that they can be like a portal to something bigger. The trick is sort of... developing the sort of courage, in a way, and sort of the fearlessness to stay with it longer and longer, because what happens in my experience is you might have that for a moment, you might be able to stay with it in that openness and that sense of not knowing what's coming next, not knowing what's going to happen for a little while, and then you kind of, the anxiety gets the better of you and you start sort of go, I don't know what I'll do, I'll build a little spindly tower and stand on top of that. And and you start to sort of tell yourself all these stories about how, no, this time I'm going to build it right and it's going to work. The plans are all going to come through and everything's going to go fine. It's just because I'm in the wrong job. It's just because I'm in the wrong town. And you construct another story to sort of keep that sort of direct experience, that experience of things changing and being... conditioned at bay. Quite a few years ago, I found this article. If you remember Paula Yates, the celebrity who was, I think she was married to Michael Hutchence, and she committed suicide. There was this article with her, sort of the last interview that she'd done, and she's obviously sort of in a real bad place. And there was this, I don't remember much of the other article, but I cut out this little line from it. And in it she said, your concept of who you are and what you were and what was going to happen in the future can disappear at 3 a.m. And I kind of thought, I know what she means. So sort of that somehow it is that sort of your sense of what the world is and what's going to happen and your security. It's just a story a lot of the time, and And really, when that's taken away, or when we really look at what's there in experience, we realise we're quite sort of vulnerable, we're quite fragile. So that's the one side of it, that's the side of it where it feels like death, like drowning. But what sort of Subhuti is getting at, and sort of what Buddhist teaching is saying, is letting go of that stuff, is letting go of what limits us, is sort of freeing up some space so that we can be spiritually reborn. But I think, it seems quite common that people have that kind of experience that would be a sort of spiritual death, but they have no sort of framework for it. They have no spiritual teaching or spiritual teacher to put that in perspective or explain why they feel like that or what the meaning of it is. So they're like someone like Paul Yates said, they're just lost. They don't find a new way, another way out. They perhaps just sort of drown, and that's it, unfortunately. So what, in a way, sort of just, I'm not going to go into it too much, but just what we do, I suppose, as part of a spiritual practice, is before we really go into that stage of spiritual death, where we perhaps start doing practices which sort of draw that experience out by contemplating impermanence. Before we do any of that, we really need to have firstly sort of cultivate a lot of positive emotion, but then also have faith in the path, faith in the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and faith that's what comes after spiritual death. Without that, you'd just sort of be quite lost, and it would be just very overwhelming, I think, and hard to come through. So I'll just talk a bit personally, actually, about some experiences. And when I was very young, when I was ill, if ever I had sort of, quite often if I had flu or stomach bug or something like this, I'd often have these recurring dreams that I was sort of disembodied, but all I could see was this sort of infinite sea, this sort of infinite ocean. And then in the dreams, it was just quite horrifying or something quite oppressive by this image of this great sea. It felt like I was somehow going to be sort of squashed, wiped out, sort of squashed out. I can't think of the words. Squitted out, I wanted to say. And it didn't mean much to me at the time. It was just horrible. I think I was sort of like a little kid. But when I started to meditate, I went on my first solitary, and I had an experience in meditation which was pretty much the same experience, just sort of doing the mindfulness of breathing, I think, and just entered this kind of experience. It recurred again in my meditation this time, sort of every couple of months. And then I got to a point where it happened again, and I'd started to sort of try and work with it, so try and sort of stay with the experience rather than just finding it just too much. And it started to take on another form, another image came with it. And that was me sort of sat meditating, and above me, sort of an inch above my head, was a planet. There's this sense that I could just sort of feel the weight of it sort of on top of me, and it was like I'd feel sort of sick with the dread of it or something. But I got into just sort of trying to relax, trying to just experience what was actually there, rather than my fear and the stories of my fear. And the outcome of doing that approach to it was, I sort of started to merge with this thing that I was picturing as a planet or the sea, and started to feel that it wasn't different to me. I wasn't going to be wiped out by it. I was sort of going to become as big as it. And then I sort of had that experience of it sort of, and the whole experience changed. Like as soon as I felt like I'd merged with it, it became blissful. and it became sort of expansive, and I was sort of almost like I was as big as this planet had been. And I suppose I sort of understand that as just sort of entering a more direct experience of consciousness somehow, sort of just having a more expanded sense of consciousness, and not just sort of being in these thoughts, these narrow stories about my experience. But I couldn't sustain that experience. I very quickly sort of came out of it. But and sort of similar experiences, what I think they've sort of given me is a sense of something more real. That somehow that is quite hard to sort of say why that seems more real, but just intuitively and from the experience, I just know that there's something, I'm more like that than I am the stories I tell of myself. And there's something much more attractive about that state than the stories and the ideas of myself. So what I think I find now is I still have lots of stories about myself. I still have all sorts of plans and all that sort of stuff. But I think I'm able to sort of see it as more... I certainly do get enmeshed in it and sort of disappointed all the rest of it. But I sort of know as I'm doing it a bit more clearly that it is artificial. It is not the way things really are. It is sort of not my true nature, how I'm picturing myself. I'm quite relieved because it's quite boring how I picture myself day to day. I sort of had that experience. If I go to Vajraloka, I find myself going into a Vajraloka state of mind, which is, oh God, I've got to meditate. Oh. And it's just sort of like, I know it's going to be hard work, or I have this idea it's going to be hard work, and I just sort of slip into, and the same when I go to my parents, I just slip into this habit of how I perceive myself, how I react, how I see everything when I'm in that environment. And I think it's hard to shake these off, but that is just habit. That is just picking up the old book and reading the same descriptions again. But if we could really be in our experience moment to moment, we'd be able to just sort of break through that and just experience this sort of this vastness and this sort of openness, this potential. So I'll just, I've nearly finished. I'll just say a little bit more about what Subhuti said at this talk about spiritual rebirth. And he said the more we can let go of these notions of ourselves, the more the less sort of restricted we are by them. It's almost as though, from my diagram, that we're sort of tethered to this platform. We're tethered, like it's like we're tied to a pole, and we can't stray far from that pole. We can't sort of experience ourselves beyond that, the length of this cord that's attached us to that. But when we realise that the thing we're tied to is just a construct, is just a fiction, we can just sort of keep going. We can just expand. And he says that then what happens is consciousness emerges in fluid, flexible and open ways. And at this point, we become able to sense the trembling of meanings beyond the intellect. There is a spiritual openness and receptivity. We become able to hear the still small voice. And just to indulge in another experience of my own, because I think it sort of fits quite well with this sort of the whole thing I've described in a way, sort of what gave rise to it as well. Sort of another is a dream, actually, this was. And it begins with a sort of what led to it was I asked the girl out and she said no, basically. That was the dukkha, that was the plan falling apart, the disappointment, etc. This was the portal opening for me. I didn't quite appreciate it initially, but the portal sort of opened up in my dreams that night. And I had this dream where again, a sort of disembodied dream. And what was before me was this sort of space, like outer space. And then there's these bars of light in a sort of square, forming a square, sort of a box shape. And what was happening is these bars of light were just sort of floating apart. And they kept floating apart. And that was excruciatingly painful for me to experience. Somehow I was the box and I had to keep these bars of light together. But the universe kept making them stretch out and fall apart. But with my mind, I could kind of go and sort of push them back. And I kept doing this. And then I realized that the universe will just keep doing that forever. I'm getting a bit tired now. And when that struck me, I just thought, it's such strong feelings that came with this. It's sort of, the image of it doesn't quite give, like it felt like I was going to die, basically, if these bars of light went out. And I felt like that was it. There was no more Atabandhu. It would be gone. And so I was just sort of going, keep it. And I was just sort of on the verge of sort of waking myself up from this sort of horrible experience. And there was a little voice that wasn't, well, in the dream as I experienced it, wasn't from me. And it said, "This is where you find freedom." And then I woke up and checked that I still had a body. But it's a very, very strong dream. That seemed a very significant dream. And I didn't, in a way, it was telling me to just let go, to sort of let that happen and have no fear, because this is where you find freedom. I didn't let go even slightly. I still think I sort of learnt something from that experience. I still got sort of some faith has come from that little voice that was quite confident and was sort of knew the way things were somehow. I don't know where that voice came from or whatever, but that seemed like a very significant dream to me. And I guess that's sort of the kind of, maybe it comes from cultivating faith in the path and in that there is something like the potential of a Buddha sort of beyond this kind of death. So I'll just finish with the Rumi poem where I sort of stole the idea for the images from. It's just a little passage from one of his poems. The captain stalks the deck of the ship. The planks are his fears of the bad things that may happen, and the joists are his longing for all the marvellous things that may happen. When the planks and the joists both go, nothing is left but the drowning. My teacher is the ocean, and the pearl deep in the ocean.